The girl's a fool, she broke the rules, she heard a lie. This time he will break down.
Robel sounds broke down. This is Jennifer Lawrence from Acra. And you are listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
Hi everyone, my name is Stella. Please join me for a half hour of music from the 1930s and 40s. Every week I will share some of my favorite classics with an occasional surprise song from a different genre or decade. Hope you'll tune in from 3:30 to 4 o'clock every Wednesday.
Kiss me once, then kiss me twice. Kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I am here with Margaret Solisky in her studio in Hudson. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, the first question I usually ask people is, how did you end up in Hudson?
Well, we were living in New York, and we had a loft on Bond Street downtown, and we found that we kept renting out more and more of our space in order to support ourselves as artists. And one day we walked through the space and realized that everybody was living in our loft and doing their work. And Tony was teaching at Parsons, and I was doing graphic design work. And it just occurred to us that we were spending too much time trying to be in New York and not doing our work. And the art scene also changed a lot in the 80s. So we were just feeling a little less connected, and we thought, well, we'll move out of the city, and we, Tony will tell you, drew a line or a circle around and figured how far out could we get, and Tony still had to teach at Parsons. So we were attracted to both the architecture and that the train stopped here. Those are two big things. That was in 1989. Hudson was a very different place.
1989?
Yeah. All our friends came up from the city to visit us and said, what are you doing? You're going to bring your daughter up here? It was a very intense scene, and Warren Street was all boarded up, and it was a lot of people living in storefronts then because there were no shops to occupy those spaces. There's a lot of drug dealing going on, but it still has beautiful architecture. And the antique dealers were just beginning to sort of take over and revitalize it. So we were just so amazed by the full history of architecture on Warren Street. So that was the attraction.
And so Tony then got a job, I guess, at the college.
The college, right.
I'll talk to him about that
mm-hmm.
later.
Yeah.
And what did you do in those days?
Well, it was an interesting time for graphic design work. I was supporting my sculpture with doing paste-ups, mechanicals, and graphic layout. And at that time, the computer was just beginning to replace T-squares and triangles and ruling pens, all these fabulous tools that I really enjoyed working with, you know, slide rules and stuff. And I really didn't want to hop onto the computer thing. It was just so cold. It was just not particularly interesting. So I moved up here, and I did do some jobs for a while, taking them down to the city. But then I apprenticed with Tad Fallon in antique restoration out in Copake. He now has a business, Fallon Wilkinson. He's a conservator of antique and wood furniture. And then I started to work with Sotheby's. So I worked in their lacquer department.
Doing restoration?
Doing restoration. Pretty much trained by Tad Fallon out in Copake. And his family has the Copake auction. And Tad was going to school in conservation work, so he needed somebody to sort of run his shop while he was going off. I think it was 4 weeks every so often to the conservation program he was in. So I helped him out, and he taught me restoration work. I've always enjoyed manipulating materials and working with materials in my hand, so it was, I feel very lucky that I was able to move up here and find something that is agreeable to me to support my sculpture.
And then eventually you got that pretty long and involved job of restoration work at Olana.
Yes, well, also when I was working with Tad, after he then decided to open his own business, and I left him and worked for Sotheby's, and then I went off on my own. I decided I had enough of working full-time in a shop, and I wanted to be home in my studio and do work. And I started to volunteer for the state of New York up at Peebles Island, where they treat a lot of the furniture that's in the historic collection. And that's how, because Olana is a state historic site, so that's how that came about, was working with Joyce Sucker, who at that time was the head paintings conservator of Peebles Island.
And how long did you work at Olana?
That was a project to conserve the stencils. And so we did it year by year. And it was wonderful, because being able to be in Olana when nobody else was there, watch it get light in the morning, watch it get dark at night, because it was during the winter that I did the court hall. I did the downstairs and two parlors, and then eventually they got funding to do the upstairs as well. So it was over several years, because you always do studies and tests, and there's a lot of preparation and testing what will work before you actually go in and start to treat something.
And were you matching colors?
Well, what we tried to do was clean the surface, because there was a lot of soot from the furnaces and coal-fired environment. They kept the windows open. Flies came in. There was flies spattering up by the ceiling. So initially what you just try to do is clean the surface so that when you restore the losses, your touch-up matches. But it was proved to be a very difficult surface to clean. I worked with the painting department at Peebles Island, and we tried a lot, but back then he was mixing his own paints, and you know, it was a suspensions of all different kinds of materials, so there weren't really any successful cleaning systems that we came up with. It's a matte surface. It's very sensitive to any solvents or water. One thing that we did do that was interesting was laser cleaning, which you use a laser beam that ablates the dirt off the surface into a slide, like those little slips that go over slides when you're viewing something under the microscope. You know, they're tiny. They're like a half an inch square. So it was sort of like cleaning a football field with a needle. It really wasn't practical. But they've since been using lasers more in the field, so perhaps it's a possibility in the future.
Now, were you working alone?
Yes. Once we had done the studies, did the reports, then somebody has to execute the work, which involved injecting with a needle behind each flake of paint that was just hanging there on the wall, and also detecting imminent losses. So when you see just a little bit of puckering through magnifying glasses, all magnifying glasses, then you try to break into it with a needle and drop a little bit of glue behind it, and then you take a small piece of paper and you iron this down. We're talking like 1/8 of an inch at the most chips of paint. And then...
You said iron.
Iron it down because the solvent gets behind the cleaving paint.
And so you're literally using heat then to...
Then you use heat after you've injected it, you've wiped off the surplus and sort of tap it down, and then you gently heat each little section. Then wipe off the excess. And then there are losses that you sometimes try to inject and the flake falls away. Or there were also losses. And then in that case, you in paint it to match the surrounding.
What sort of paint did you use?
I think it was an acrylic polymer. It was B72 with dry pigments mixed into it. Toxic things like cyclosol and xylene.
Oh, yes.
So it's not only the magnifier on your face, but there's also a mask. And then there's headphones because it was hundreds of hours of injection. But a very satisfying project. I go back occasionally to see if there are any further losses. And I think it's been about 7 years now. I see only one further loss. So I was pretty good at detecting them. They had also just done a repointing of the building. So moisture that had migrated through to those stencils was then secure. So it was a good time. And they also put a new HVAC system into it. So everything was controlled. Closed up and controlled, so it was a perfect time to conserve those stencils because then the environment was stable.
Now, was this something you'd done as an artist? Or was that
no, those materials are... I try not to use toxic materials in my work, although I still use it in conservation restoration work. Those were materials that were chosen. That was a system chosen by the state, by the paintings department, through trial and error, what was the best way to... I did the work, but I worked with the conservators there who they decided how we would treat the stencils.
A sigh of relief and a sense of accomplishment when it was all
it
done.
It was, yeah, because I also gave a lot of time for doing those studies as well.
So you are going up to People's Island.
Yes, and also working with them at Alana, making tests. We did maps that indicated what kind of losses, what kind of cracks there were. All over the wall, sort of, it's almost like snorkeling across the surface where you're just detecting every little thing and mapping it out with colored pencils.
Meanwhile, had you always been doing photography?
I've always been doing sculpture, but I've been using photography in my work for a long time.
And these are your own photographs?
Yes, they're all my own photographs, but I don't think of myself as a photographer. Photography to me is just sort of like another material that I need to have to do my work. And the image is there, and it's a known system. The landscape is a linear thing that we're all familiar with. It has foreground and midground and background. And so given that information, it allows you to manipulate it, to ambiguate the space and the distance and insert various things and in this case, mount them on aluminum and bend them and make them architectural. I think these pieces I did is on aluminum that are bent. I did when I just had my studio built, and I was working with Grigory Fetyev, who designed the building for me. So the process of working with him in my space, I kept trying to think of how is the landscape framed and how does this go around the corner? And I really think that the building and the process of thinking about the kind of studio I wanted influenced a lot of these pieces. But I've always been interested in architecture and monumental things.
And did you go to art school?
I went to Bennington College in Vermont for undergraduate, and then I did what's called the Whitney Museum Independent Studio Program. They have a program in New York that's a studio art program, and there's also an art history part to it as well, and I did the studio art. I was a double major in painting and in sculpture.
So what was your first sculpture medium?
Well, at Bennington there was a lot of pressure to do steel sculpture. It had a long tradition of the Green Mountain Boys, Anthony Caro, Isaac Wipkin was teaching there. They were all the big steel guys, and they had fabulous steel studio, everything you wanted, all the steel and the welding machines and everything. And so that was the first thing, was to learn how to weld, which I immediately became disinterested in. I'm very exacting, and when you weld something, you have to cut it, you weld it, and then if you don't like those hideous welding marks, which look like snails traveling across a surface, you have to grind them. So the process is very tedious, and so it's like printmaking. You know, there's a lot of preparation and care and wiping, and the process to me wasn't immediate enough. So I worked a lot at Bennington with a glue gun.
With a glue gun?
Yes.
Oh, yes?
With a glue gun, and I also hung my pieces. My pieces were projections off the wall, so that was a stable structure. I had the wall, so, and I've pretty much stuck with working off the wall. I enjoy working off the wall. You can control the space. It's frontal and from the side. You don't have to account for the back as well.
Well, all your work is very sensitive.
Thank you. It's and it's pretty small scale. A lot of people have seen photographs and gone, wow. You know, when I see them in real life, they're so tiny. And that's, they're small for two reasons. I like, they're personal. And they are a certain size because of me and my body size when I'm working with them. And also working with the materials, with my hands, the proportions seem right for me. And also they're what I can handle as far as construction. Sculptors always have to build what they have in mind. Painters, they just stretch another canvas. I'll go into Tony's studio and he just stretches another canvas or gets out another piece of paper and he's good to go. Whereas I'll spend all day constructing something and then at the end of the day, and then I'll step to the table saw and cut the left-hand corner off because I didn't really need that section, whereas he could just paint it out. So construction is, you know, something that's always there. You have it in mind, then you actually have to build it one way or another.
And now you say a lot of these are mounted on metal?
The folded pieces are mounted on aluminum, and then the aluminum is scored and cut.
So it's like sheets of aluminum?
Well, there they are.
The sheets, oh, I see. Of aluminum. Oh, right.
And I also make models and maquettes because it gets expensive just cutting up aluminum, then deciding that you want to cut off the corner. So sometimes I do make models. So when you cut it and score it and fold it, you don't really know how it's going to look three-dimensionally. You make a mark and you fold it, and it curves so much to the side more than you thought, or it projects so much more than you thought. So there's a little bit of trial and error there in how you want the photograph to wrap around it. So I often do Xeroxes and then work with cardboard to see how it's going to fold. But working with aluminum is really wonderful. It's very immediate. It's clean, the scoring and folding. It's very satisfying.
And the sheets you use, it's a thick enough gauge that they stay in place once you've...
They do. Some of them I back with a double sheet or I fold. This one here has, it's long, so it does have a double piece, so it's a little more stable. And then they're just nailed to the wall.
And each one is unique, right? I mean, it's not an addition. You don't.
No. Oh, that would be... whenever I've... even sometimes if I make a model and I love the model and the model has a certain feeling about it, and, okay, I'm going to make that one. And it's usually bigger than the model. And sometimes when it gets cleaned up or a little bigger, it just loses something. So to do something multiple would really... first, it would be boring, but I think it would not be satisfying. I like to think that the original piece has something special that perhaps gets lost if it's duplicated. Or I would probably change it. What would happen is I would start to duplicate it, and then I would probably change it just to keep my interest.
You've gone out and taken photographs out in nature first.
Right.
And then I guess you print those and you decide how you'll be, sort of figure out how you're going to use them.
It's sort of the structure and the landscape go together. You look at a landscape and it sort of suggests how it might be folded or where you might take out a section. There really is, I can't say that I put up the photograph and say, okay, I'm going to make a piece with this one now. They sort of happen together, and they happen just in the process. Most of my work happens in the process. Sometimes I do working drawings where I'm really measuring stuff out on tracing paper, and I know I'm going to cut so many pieces on the saw this size. And because I do work in the scale, I really draw it out to scale on the tracing paper. So they are really working drawings where it's going to be cut to size. But for the most part, it's just I had that photograph mounted on there and then sliced out the center and shifted it to the right. You know, it's always wanting to manipulate the landscape. I've never been happy with just mounting a photograph and saying, that's it. And even now, I've started to cut up the photographs and alter the photographs themselves.
Do you make them around here, the photos? I mean, is this where you...
A lot of them are Hudson River. There's the buoys you probably recognize that they pull out of the water in the winter. This take a lot of photographs of Alana at Alana. But this is Fioli Gardens in San Francisco, and this is the quarries in Gloucester, Connecticut.
You do your own printing?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's another thing that confines the size, is that my printer is only this big. And because I'm not really a photographer, I have this reluctance to commit myself to one of those giant printers that have tanks that suck down $200 worth of ink. Because the other thing is that, you know, I'm not printing all the time. So then you have problems with things clogging. So I've committed myself to this printer that takes enough ink. And the other thing is that I can print in pieces if I need to. Like this could have been printed in three pieces. So I can still get the scale since I'm going to cut it up anyway. So I don't need to pull a photograph all in one piece. And I'll often print it out on our little printer in Tony's studio and just a piece of Xerox to see how it did. I've never been able to have somebody else print or fabricate for me. And I ran into trouble when I started to make these pieces here with the plexiglass and these two over here, especially the aqua one, because you see the plexiglass is cut out in the center. And I initially did that with Mylar, where I tinted the Mylar, but the Mylar buckled, depending on if it's hot or cold or humid. So I had to figure out how to cut the plexiglass. And, you know, I could have somebody do that for me. But that will cost money, and you're committing to the shape. And then you get it in your studio, and then what happens is what I said, you want to cut off the left-hand side.
Right, right,
so...
Right.
I found this material is not actually plexiglass. It's called Lexan, and so it's much more flexible. You don't have to worry about it shattering or chipping, and so I'm able to cut those on the saws, on the bandsaw. I could have had somebody, I don't know that I could have had somebody actually give me that color, but I could have them. You know, they do this digital cutting now, which is amazing. They laser cut.
Now, you're having this show at Davis Horton.
Yes.
And how many pieces will you have?
Well, I have the map of the gallery, and I have 16 pieces on the map. But I went over to the gallery on Saturday, and the problem with sculpture, and sculpture that hangs on the wall, is that it projects. So when you have a corner, you think of putting a few pieces on the corner, but then on the other side, the view can be obscured because the one on the opposite wall is projecting into it. So I think what I'll do is take the pieces over and then just start installing them and see. And also, I'm conflicted about doing just the folded metal landscape pieces or including also these more recent pieces with the plexiglass, because they're very different pieces. Of course, the artists, they always seem dramatically different, but perhaps to somebody else, it looks like.
Well, no, it looks like a different tack.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I started photographing industrial sites in the wintertime because they have such interesting things in them. They have the Troy waterfront has these beautiful blue tanks. And when you see them in the snow, they're just fantastic. And so I started photographing colored machinery in an otherwise bland winter landscape. And those pieces of machinery really pop out in color. I also started to feel like I really wanted to work with color, which there's not a lot of color in these pieces. So I imbued that one with yellow. But that color is almost like a whole other material. And I tend to keep things at a minimum. So material and color, photograph, how many elements do you want playing off of each other? I tend to keep it very minimal.
Now, in this particular one, you're using color on the depth of the piece to reflect on the wall.
Yeah, that's interesting. That comes out of this piece over here. This piece was done first, and that's taken from the landfill in Manhattan, probably from the Whitney Museum or maybe from Uptown where they were. I don't know if they're demolishing or building this, but you know there's that plastic fence there forming the L. And I then picked it up and used it in the piece. It's a diptych to the piece to the left. And I really liked that iridescent pink. But it wasn't in this photograph. But I thought I would just put it in over there, and then I loved the way it glowed on the wall. I've always wanted to use lights, to put lights in pieces for transparency. And now, of course, you can get little lights. You can, in fact. You don't have to have that cord hanging down from the monitor like we used to have to have.
Those cords were always a distraction.
They were. I can't ignore something like that. I don't know how people were able to. And then all those monitors that Vito Acconci used were so ugly. Now you walk into a room and it's wrap-around, wall-to-wall film, and it's just wonderful for people who are making film now and never loved video monitors. Well, in digital photography, that's when I first started to use photography, and I'd take all these, because I'm not really interested in photography. Again, it's like working in steel. It has a process and a knowledge and f-stops and exposures and shutters and all the stuff that just doesn't interest me. So when digital photography came out with zoom lenses, I have a little pocket digital camera that zooms like crazy so that I can crop, because I do a lot of cropping. And it just liberated me. It was immediate. You could put it in the computer. You had it. And I do a minimal amount of photoshopping, but I mostly like to zoom in on what interested me in the first place. Digital photography has been great for non-photographers, and it really makes photographers furious because they know they have skills, they know their medium so well, the quality of a print, the focus, the everything is so critical in a beautiful photograph, and I respect it and appreciate it so much, but it's not what I need. If it's like a little too green, a little out of focus, I'll use it. Well, we can certainly end this now, and I hope that you'll see the show at Davis Orton, and it opens on the 16th and closes on, I think, the 8th of July. I'm very enthusiastic about showing there. I think they show interesting photographs. It's not just a photography gallery. Variations on photography, and there's also the artist books that she does, and Karen Davis also is a photographer and does photographs I really admire.
Well, thank you very much, Margaret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're welcome.
That was Margaret Soliski. Now for some Mendelssohn Piano Trio number 2 in C minor, performed by Luke Tsu on violin, Rainer Crossett on cello, and Sophie Skolnick-Brower on piano.
Thank you.
the sycamore. Moonlight, icy finger waves, ski trails on a mountainside, snowlight. Telegraph cable.